From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Reading, Writing, and Obsession, we feature an onstage interview with British novelist A.S. Byatt. Her novel Possession won the Booker Prize and was a bestseller. Angels and Insects was made into an arthouse film. Byatt's new novel is the biographer's tale. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews some classic and new writing about food. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new tribute album to Teresa Stern, the former musical prodigy who became the head of Nonesuch Records. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An earthquake struck the Seattle area in Washington state today. Dozens of people were injured, but few of the injuries are said to be serious. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more on the magnitude 6.8 quake.
The most powerful earthquake to hit Washington state in more than half a century struck just before 11 this morning. The deep quake, 30 miles underground, was centered about 35 miles southwest of Seattle. It was felt as far away as Portland, Oregon, and Vancouver, British Columbia. Buildings were damaged and windows were shattered throughout Seattle, and in Olympia, the dome of the state capitol was cracked. State buildings sustained major damage. All but essential employees were sent home. At Seattle International Airport, limited service has now been resumed, but Boeing Field, a smaller regional facility, is likely to be shut down for days. Seattle's Mayor Paul Schell said today the city's effort to retrofit older structures, including bridges, paid off. Ironically, the federal budget President Bush submitted to Congress today does away with a federal program to help communities prepare for disasters, including earthquakes. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
President Bush said he's sending his Federal Emergency Management Agency director to Seattle to assist local authorities in dealing with the earthquake. Joe Albaugh will leave tonight to help assess the damage. The president said the administration will find whatever resources are necessary. President Bush is seeking public support for the budget proposals he sent to Congress today, and the president's on a two-day tour of the Midwest and South. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The president is trying to win over the public for his budget and his $1.6 trillion tax cut plan by going out into the country and talking about them both. Today he met with small business leaders in Beaver, Pennsylvania, and in Council Bluffs, Iowa, where he defended his call for an across-the-board tax cut. Critics say such a plan means most of the benefit will go to the richest Americans. The president called that charge class warfare and said a fair tax cut is one that cuts taxes for everyone. At a rally in downtown Omaha, several hundred people cheered the president's tax plan, and when he talked about education reforms. Nebraska is a state he carried easily, and people here were thrilled to welcome the president to their town. Tomorrow, Mr. Bush will be in Little Rock in Atlanta. He promises to tour the country selling his proposals. Don Gagne, NPR News, Omaha.
Stocks closed lower today after Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan indicated to Congress that it's unlikely the central bank will cut interest rates before monetary policymakers hold their next meeting. Greenspan told a House committee that he believes the economic downturn hasn't played itself out yet because businesses still haven't unloaded big inventories that backed up when sales started to drop off. The next meeting of the Fed's interest rate setting committee is scheduled for March 20th. In stocks today, the Dow lost 142 points, or 1.3%. This is NPR News. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has asserted his country's right to defend itself. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Bahrain.
Saddam told troops from anti-aircraft units that Baghdad was determined to defend itself against attack by Iraq's enemies. We are not lovers of collecting arms, and we do not have a hobby of searching for the most lethal weapons, Saddam said, but we will not hesitate to possess weapons to defend Iraq and the Arab nation. U.S. and British warplanes attacked Iraqi air defense installations near Baghdad in mid-February. Washington said they were threatening Allied planes patrolling no-fly zones in Iraq. Both Secretary of State Colin Powell and U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan have called for a strengthening of military sanctions against Baghdad. Iraq is believed to still possess weapons of mass destruction. It ruled out allowing the return of U.N. weapons inspectors during recent talks at the U.N. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Bahrain.
Delta Airlines is still trying to negotiate a new contract with its pilots as a deadline approaches that could lead to binding arbitration or a strike. The airline and its nearly 10,000 pilots have agreed to ask federal mediators for binding arbitration if they fail to reach agreement by tomorrow. If either side rejects the arbitration, it could lead to a 30-day cooling-off period, with a strike possible as early as April 1st. The National Mediation Board could also order the two sides to keep talking through the month of March. In either case, travelers are looking uneasily at the prospect of a work stoppage at the nation's third-largest airline. In stocks today, the Nasdaq lost 56 points, or 2.5%. It closed at 2,151. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. British writer A.S. Byatt is best known in this country for her Booker Prize-winning novel Possession, about two academics who follow a trail of literary clues and discover a love affair between two Victorian poets. In the process, they fall in love. Byatt uses this story-within-a-story technique again in her new book, The Biographer's Tale. It's about a failed academic, Phineas Gilbert Nansen, who attempts to write a biography of a Victorian biographer by the name of Scholes Destry Scholes. I spoke with A.S. Byatt recently before a live audience at the Free Library of Philadelphia as part of their author series, Rebuilding the Future. One of the things Nansen discovers in his research are notes Scholes made on the art of writing biography. Scholes maintain that a biographer must never lay claim to what he doesn't know. I asked A.S. Byatt if this isn't a two-edged proposition, since all writing is in some sense an attempt to lay claim to the unknown.
Absolutely, and there's a kind of sentence that biographers commit, I think is the word I'll use. They say, as Scholes go on to say, they say he must have felt when he saw Durham Cathedral, he must have remembered that he was married there. But they don't know. And I have read biographies that start with a completely imagined scene, saying, you know, so-and-so looked out of a window and felt very moved because he knew that soon his new young wife would approach up the alley. Well, all that is, that one's an invented example, but there are things that start just like that. You know, one day in 1812, a young woman was sitting at her writing desk and wrote down the words, Persuasion, a novel by a gentlewoman. Well, she may or may not have done. You don't know, and the moment you start describing it as though you were there and saw it, you're writing a novel or something that isn't quite true.
Biography, though, is very in vogue right now, and I've noticed that people are often more likely to read a biography of a famous author than to read the actual works themselves. That happens a lot.
Well, this is what started me, of course. Many, many years ago, I got into a fit of terrible indignation about this. It had two arms to it. One of the arms was that if you write a biography of Virginia Woolf, you will get an enormous amount of reviewing space in a newspaper. The newspaper reviewer will in turn write an elegant little biographical essay on Virginia Woolf and what the biographer did and didn't know. Readers and students will rush off and read the biography. You don't find many of them who've actually read Virginia Woolf.
No, the lighthouse is not flying off the shelves.
It is not flying off the shelves. And people talk knowledgeably about Virginia Woolf. And beyond that, they will probably read her notebook or her letters. And if you say Virginia Woolf is a great writer, they say, yes, her letters are absolutely wonderful. They're so wicked, which is true. But she thought that she had written several great works of art, and this was her claim to fame. She thought that everybody would know that The Waves was one of the great modern novels. If you wander around now, apart from Woolf specialists, you don't meet people who have read The Waves, but they all know everything she thought. They know what she thought about the reviews of The Waves.
Along those lines, I was very interested in a passage in this new book, Biographers, The Biographer's Tale. It's about Phineas' disgust at the idea that people should find themselves through reading, that a person would understand themselves better by identifying with a character or, say, identifying with the subject of a biography. And he says that's just nonsense, and here we're talking about fiction. And this is a quote: "The true literary fanatic, the primeval reader, is looking for anything but a mirror, for an escape route, for an expanding horizon, for receding starscapes, for unimaginable monstrosities and incomprehensible, strictly beauties." I thought that was a beautiful, interesting description of reading, and I wondered if you could talk about it, what you look for in your reading of fiction, and perhaps what we sometimes look for in fiction misguidedly.
My heart always sank when I was teaching a book and one of the students would say complainingly, "I'm terribly sorry, I just can't identify with that character." But this is a double-edged weapon, because I think actually a good reader, Phineas is only half right. A good reader must identify with a character. And paradoxically, I write most of my novels in the third person, because I think you actually identify more closely with somebody through a writer's description. And a first person actually pushes you away. And I think I chose Phineas for that reason. He shouts so much himself that I don't think you identify with him at all.
He's
you just observe
wretched.
Him.
He's so annoying.
Yeah, he's terribly annoying. He annoys me. But equally, he's right about reading being a kind of immense sort of world outside yourself. You know, through reading, you get into a huge world of other things, of things you don't know by other means, of people whose experience is so different from yours. An example I've recently taken to giving, because I've only just realized how interesting it is, was the shock I had at the age of about 8 reading Uncle Tom's Cabin. I didn't know that people had been slaves. I mean, imagine a child, a respectable English child in its grandmother's house, suddenly stumbling across the fact that the world had been like that. It's very good for me to have known that, and somebody made me imagine that that was the case. It frightened me to death for weeks and months. Equally, you can find something extraordinarily beautiful. You know, you can read descriptions of going up the River Amazon, or you can read about people whose thought processes you do understand but would never have thought of before that. And I prefer the kind of reading that's a discovery of something other than myself. You know, I like something to be added rather than nod my head and say, yes, yes, that's quite right, I know, I feel like that.
Is it a juggling act for you? We've been talking about things, facts. Is it a juggling act for you to balance the facts with your fiction? I'm thinking, are you thinking of our attention span as readers?
It is a juggling act. I mean, this book is dangerous about the attention span, because although it does tell a story, which I believe you should do, and it tells a story with a beginning and a middle and an end, and Phineas's emotions change, it's got an awful lot of, as it were, a kind of collage, like a stamp collection of things and observations and little other stories inside it.
As do many of your other books.
Yes. Yes, but this is more so, I think. This is about that process. This is, in a sense, an exposing of the way the novelist works. You know, I stick all these things and quotations next to each other and see if some new thing will come to life out of them, which, of course, it always does, because human beings must make patterns.
A.S. Byatt from an onstage interview recorded last week. We'll continue our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're back with novelist A.S. Byatt. Her new book is The Biographer's Tale. When we spoke, I asked her where her passion for Victorian writers comes from.
It comes from my childhood, really. I grew up with... I had three colouring books. And it had sort of... they had pre-Raphaelite pictures in for me to fill in the colours of. And one was The Lady of Shalott by Tennyson, with a, you know, it was quite a fat colouring book with lots and lots of pictures of the Lady of Shalott. And the next was The Mort d'Arthur, also by Tennyson. And the third was Browning's Pied Piper of Hamelin. And I read these books over and over and over and over again, and the rhythms of the Victorian poetry sing in my head. And when I went up to Cambridge as a student, I was deeply shocked to find that these poets were thought to be dreadfully bad poets that had somehow betrayed English poetry and shouldn't be studied. And Possession is dedicated to my friend Professor Isabel Armstrong, who was making a one-woman career of saying these are actually great poets who should be taken seriously. They're not secondary writers. They're major great writers. It is... That's where the passion comes from. It's not really the novelists, it's the poets who got me. This is still quite unfashionable, I think.
Well, my heart is just bleeding thinking of the colouring books my children have at home. Scooby-Doo and
Well, the real the horror mermaid. Was that I daredn't colour them, because once I'd coloured them, it would have been done. Mm. You know, I daredn't... And one of my siblings scribbled on one of them, a much littler child, you know, just took a coloured pencil and didn't fill in these beautiful images of the Lady of Shalott with her web and her loom and the window. I don't think I ever coloured anything in. I left them in black and white. I've never said this to anyone before, ever. But I left them in black and white lines as though there was something to be put in later when I learned how to do it. Very strange.
Was the rest of your family life as literary as your books, your colouring books?
The thing about my family life was that all the good bits of it were literary. The house was full of books. My mother had studied English at Cambridge also. My mother and father had been in the same class at Mexborough Grammar School, which was just a grammar school, but it had a teacher of genius who had inspired several generations of students to go to Cambridge. And she'd also taught them to recite almost the whole of English literature by heart. And my parents, when everybody was happy, would sit together in the motor car or over the Sunday lunch and just recite great wadges of English poetry. And if one of them forgot a line, the other one would put it in. And this was what they did when they were really happy. So I thought, somehow one grew up feeling that language and literature were the important thing. Also, it was very narrow. I mean, we were a family that didn't have any of the other things you might have had. We were no good at sport. We had some reproductions of Van Gogh's paintings on the wall, but when one of my sisters became an art historian, my mother said, "Is there really anything to be said about art history?" And, which I'm
That's
sure
supportive.
My sister did that in order to escape the whole thing. And we were totally unmusical. We can't sing a note in tune and we aren't interested. So it was narrow and deep, really.
Did you know you wanted to be a writer?
Yes.
As a child.
I mean, I did write. I wrote all the time. And I think I knew it very easily when I was little. I thought that the obvious response to The Lady of Shalott was to try to do that. And then I thought that about all the children's stories I read. And then I got a bit daunted as I got older and bumped into people that I couldn't write like. But I don't ever read anything without thinking, how would I do this? What can I learn from this? And so it became clear to me that that was what I wanted. I never had any wish to be a writer. It's quite important to distinguish between being a writer and writing. I wanted to write.
And what did being a writer mean to you? Something different?
Yes, it meant having the character of a writer and sitting on platforms talking to people about Doris Lessing once said very severely to an audience, you will never become a writer if you want to be a writer. You better go away and think about the act of constructing a book. That's what I really meant. But I didn't think I shall be a good person if I am a writer. I thought I have got to make sentences or I shall go mad.
I did read that you had asthma as a child. Did that figure into your living very intensely through reading and writing?
Yes, it did. I mean, I spent sort of 1 week, 2 weeks in bed, 1 week, 2 weeks at school. And when I was in bed, I read and I read and I read. And that was my life, really. And I think there are a great many writers, including Proust, whose original impulse was being in bed with asthma or some other illness. Iris Murdoch's husband, John Bailey, once said that a lot was lost to English literature when tuberculosis was cured. And what I think asthmatics tend to have in common that they get slowed down by having to keep very still or they can't breathe, whereas tubercular people were very excitable and rushed around. It was a different kind of occupational hazard.
You do, though, explore in your book's possession, in this book also, how people get addicted, possessed by books and their intellectual pursuits at the expense of living their lives and recognizing the things around them and the people around them. And I do know you're the mother of four children. You raised a family while working, while writing. How did that tension or that conflict play itself out in your life?
I can hardly bear to remember the tension and the conflict. My three daughters are very happy women, successful women. They don't appear to be neglected. My eldest daughter is bringing up three children of her own, of whom I can certainly say that they are sort of wonderfully stable, intelligent, outgoing children. The strain of having to stop writing, or indeed of having to earn my living by teaching in order to pay a nanny to help to look after the children so that every now and then I did a tiny bit of writing. The terror of my life is being stopped from writing when I don't expect to be stopped. I learned to get very, very disciplined about not even thinking about the writing. I never even tried to write at the weekends, because that was the children's time. One of my daughters then told somebody who came to interview me about asthma. I said, you come and talk to this person because you've got asthma too. She made a long speech about how she admired me immensely as a person, but I was no sort of a mother. And so I sort of sat there taking all this, and the interviewer recorded it all. And when the interviewer had gone, I looked at my daughter and I thought, now shall I say, listen, I do love you, or I am a mother. And then she said, you know, there's nothing on that tape. So I said, what do you mean? She said, well, the cat was sitting next to it, purring into it. You'll find there's nothing on that tape. And she was dead right. She was absolutely right. The interviewer rang up and said... But I still don't know if she did it on purpose, because I daren't ask her.
On an entirely different subject, how much is involved in the editing of your books for publication in the U.S.? I was curious about that, because I would think that American publishers might make demands on you and say, Americans just... they're looking for different things in novels. They just can't put up with this and put up with cultural references.
I think I was very lucky with Possession. I did have publishers for my earlier novels, and I kept shifting publishers because somebody said, the American reader will never stand for this. That's the phrase they always use. You know, the American reader will not respond to this. And then somebody else likes it and has a go, and the American reader responds enough. But with Possession, no American publisher would look at it, except one who did take it. And she said that, you know, it had fascinated her, but of course the American reader wouldn't be able to put up with it. And she said, she sent me a letter saying, "You have spoilt a fine intrigue with all this excrescent matter. And you must take it all out again." And I said, "I can't, I'm terribly sorry, let's just give this up." And she said, no, I shall send you an edited typescript, and if you can't bear it, then we will give it up. And she took a very long time to edit the first 100 pages, during which time the book had won the Booker Prize and was doing rather well. So I rang up my agent and said, "Listen, we can find even a very small American publisher that will publish this book as it was written." And she then agreed to publish it very generously. And she said, "I still think American readers won't like it with all this stuff in it." And she printed 7,000 copies. And by January, it had sold 120,000 copies. And now they're not quite sure what sort of an animal I am, because it shouldn't have done that. And what it proved, actually, was that American readers read better than any other readers. The readers who read, read. It's just that publishers have an idea of trying to sell books to people who don't naturally read. And I think that's something to do with being a great democracy, you know. You wish to tempt the person in the supermarket to have a go at a book. But there are people in the United States who are in libraries and universities and sitting in hotel bedrooms like I am now, who love books. And you find yourself in an American bookstore, and they will all come and say, "Why don't American publishers publish more books with more things in them?"
A.S. Byatt, recorded last week at the Free Library of Philadelphia. We'll hear more of our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more conversation with A.S. Byatt. Also, there's a new series of food writing by the Modern Library. Maureen Corrigan reviews that and two other new food memoirs. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews the tribute album to Teresa Stern, the musical prodigy who became the head of Nonesuch Records. We're listening to it now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's return to our interview with novelist A.S. Byatt. Her books include the bestseller Possession, also Babel Tower and Angels and Insects. Her new book is The Biographer's Tale. We spoke recently before a live audience at the Free Library of Philadelphia as part of their Visiting Author Series. Angels and Insects was made into a movie, the insects part. Are there other films in the works for your books?
Oh, yes. Rather to my amazement, really. There are three more movies in various stages of making. Possession is largely filmed. It's being directed by Neil Labute. And I saw a bit of the work on the set, and it really looks very interesting. And Philip Haas, who made Angels and Insects, has now got an absolutely wonderful script of the other story, the other novella in the same book, about Tennyson's sister at a séance trying to call up the ghost of Arthur Henry Hallam. And he's written a wonderful script, and the finance is practically there, and the actors are all excited. And I think the thing that most amazes me is that George Miller, who made Mad Max and Babe, has bought the rights to The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye. I think that's the one that, because I can't imagine at all what he will do with that. And we had dinner together, and he kept saying, I see these two figures walking through the streets of... And I could suddenly see it. He had imagined it all through, you know. He'd made some other thing in his mind. And I do hope he gets around to making it.
Well, for a person who appreciates things, he has a huge catalogue of details,
yeah,
I think,
no,
in his movies.
He's wonderful, and I think it was the things that got him. But what he wants to do is to film the bit of the story I didn't tell, which is fine by me because I would like to see it, and it's a story I should be happy, you know, to let him do that with.
I think you are the only author I've ever heard who has liked you sound as if you've liked the film adaptations of your novel.
Well, I haven't seen Possession yet, but I've liked what I have seen. I loved Angels and Insects.
Sounds as if many people have seen it.
I shall go back and tell Philip Haas you said this, because I've begun to say to Philip when we speak on the phone, because much to my amazement we became very good friends. I say every time I do a reading, somebody asks me rather anxiously what I thought of the film, and when I say I loved it, they say, oh, good. I've never met anyone who dislikes the film, though there must be people. But any one of my readers, and this must be most unusual, because most writers are very ambivalent about...
Well, of course, most readers hate the movies.
Yes, most readers hate the movies, but you see, this audience actually applauded the movie. This is great.
Taste, they have.
It was a very, very clever movie, made on a shoestring, and beautifully cast, I think. And the costume designer was a genius.
A.S. Byatt from an onstage interview recently in Philadelphia. As part of the evening's event, Byatt took questions from the audience.
I have a three-part question. One of our recent favorites is John Goldsworthy, and we were interested in finding out what you thought of his works. One of the things he accomplished in his lifetime was to win a Nobel Prize, and that's the second question, when do you think that will happen for you? And number three, what will you do with the money that you win when you win the Nobel Prize?
It's a very long time since I read Goldsworthy. And when you said that, I thought, my God, I've forgotten. I must go back to him. But it's a big undertaking. I can't quite see myself winning the Nobel Prize, partly for reasons of too much literary detail, and I think partly for reasons of being too English, though...
What does that mean, being too English?
Well, it means that people on juries in other countries don't quite know where you're coming from, although I'm beginning to be thought of by the Europeans as a European writer now. And also, I think, partly because I don't have any political angle on anything, and the Swedish jury really does like a political angle. But I was at a great book fair in Frankfurt when Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize, and I was actually driving along in my German publisher's car, and he was completely convinced that Sace Notterbohm was going to win it. And he turned the radio on to hear the announcement, and it said an American woman has won the Nobel Prize. And then it said Toni Morrison, and he went, and I began to dance up and down and wave my arms. And we actually called Toni Morrison from the restaurant, which I would never have had the guts or the nerve to do. But the German publisher said, you must call her if you're so excited. And it was a great moment. Anyway, the English, actually now Graham Greene's dead. The English always put forward Graham Greene every year. And there was somebody on the jury who hated him. So it was this kind of little closed circuit.
Do you have any fears about your work being made into films? Or are you just openly curious about what form it will take?
I do have fears. I mean, one of the fears I have... Well, there are two... No, there are an awful lot of fears. I've seen scripts of Possession that were discarded that just fill me with deep horror.
Why?
One of them was written by somebody who seemed to think it was a novel about sadism. Every time he introduced one of my characters, all of whom are actually nice, which is one of the reasons why people like Possession, he said, his face is dour and rather cruel. Everybody's face was being introduced as rather cruel. This upset me because it was wrong, but it was simply wrong, and I thought my readers of my book would discard this if it ever happened, which it didn't. But the opposite thing is even more worrying. If somebody plays one of your characters so well that you can only see the actor's face and not the imagined face, which any reader of any book must feel, I think. And they've got Gwyneth Paltrow as Maud in Possession. And she has in my mind, I've seen her recording two or three little scenes, she has in my mind slightly displaced my Maud. And I must get Maud back because she isn't quite Maud. And that bothers me. And it bothers you if one person is wrong, because then everything goes out of kilter.
She has the long neck, though.
She has the lovely, cool look as well.
Do you have any input?
I have a lot of input into Philip Farser's films because he's a born collaborator. And also he's a born telephone conversation man, and he actually calls me up on the telephone and says, listen, I could do it this way or I could do it that way, and what do you think of such? And then we end up discussing the whole of international politics, and then he rings off again. But... I had it in my contract that I could see the Possession script, which I did see about 1 week before they started shooting it. And I said, please do not make Professor Cropper into an Englishman. And I think they have made him into an American, so he doesn't look anything like I imagined him. I haven't seen him speaking, I've just seen a rush. He's about 20 years younger than I thought he was. But we shall see. And what was the other thing? They had made the main characters go to bed together about halfway through the film instead of at the end. And I said, I think this is a dreadful mistake. And rather to my amazement, they said, oh yes, we'd written two versions. We weren't quite sure. We'll make the other one. And whether they will, you will see when it happens. At least they were listening, you know. I had a very intelligent conversation about it all. Oh, and the other thing was, this is to do with libraries. When Roland first appears in the London Library in the film, he tears a strip off the librarian for having misplaced Vico for completely incomprehensible and wrong cataloguing reasons. So I said... Listen, this man is a nice man. He will not appeal to the viewers of this film if he appears as an American, being extremely rude to the London librarian, who anyway is an immensely helpful and wonderful person without whom I couldn't have written this novel, and I don't want you to insult the London. So they took that out. And the London librarian then gave them the library to film in and has had the most wonderful time and thinks they're the most wonderful people. I never read this bit of script, so all that was quite comical, but not really input.
A.S. Byatt, speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia as part of their author series, Rebuilding the Future. Our interview was recorded by Chris Fraley. Coming up, a review of new and old writings on food. This is Fresh Air. Food, glorious food. We love to eat it. Some of us even love to make it. Naturally, book critic Maureen Corrigan loves to read about food. She just feasted her eyes on the new Modern Library food series, as well as two new food memoirs. Here's what she's digested.
Yummy. That's the word that kept forming on my lips as I read, in turn, the four beautiful new paperback reprints that constitute the just-launched Modern Library food series. What is it about food writing that immediately puts me in a relaxed, happy, even giddy frame of mind? Certainly it's not the food itself, because I almost never take advantage of the recipes scattered throughout the pages of food memoirs. All that shopping and chopping and cooking, only to have the meal vanish in a few minutes. No, reading about good meals is much better than cooking them. The act of reading lasts longer, and to me, so do its pleasures. There's a delicious sensuality inherent in the subject of food, combined in these memoirs with a vivid sense of place and a delight in craft. I also love food writing for its characteristic nostalgia. Most food writers remember every mouthful of juicy pork tenderloin or syrupy strawberry tart they ever consumed. Their best meals are always somewhere in the past, when food was fresher and their palates virginal. Nostalgia certainly coats the 1943 classic Clementine in the Kitchen by Phineas Beck, whose real name was Samuel Chamberlain. This is the memoir-slash-cookbook that helped initiate the French cooking craze that swept America for the two decades after World War II. Reading it, I can see why. For Beck, French food magically conjures up a pre-lapsarian world before the war, a world filled with sleepy stone villages and street markets where leeks and pink-eyed rabbits, macaroons and apricots overflow the outdoor tables, as they had since the Middle Ages. The Becks were an American family living in a cathedral town in France during the 1930s. Clementine was their cordon bleu cook, the merry genius who initiated them into the lip-smacking glory of snails and truffles. The only slightly off taste in this story derives from Beck's patronizing way of referring to Clementine. He habitually calls her the family's most prized possession. That past freshness date language made me wonder what Clementine, whose recipes and cooking inspired this milestone memoir, thought of it. I'm also curious about whether the Beck family's most prized possession shared in the book's royalties. No such cynical questions intrude upon the enjoyment of reading the 1934 memoir, Life à la Henri, by history's first celebrity chef, Henri Charpentier. Charpentier, with a dash of help from a professional co-author, is the master of his own story. And what a story! Charpentier lived almost 100 years. As a young boy, he waited on Queen Victoria, and he ended up running a famed Hollywood restaurant with movie stars as his friends and patrons. On the pages of his memoir, as he must have been in life, Charpentier is a charmer. Here's how he begins his story. What I am going to do now, I, who invented crepe Suzette for the prince who became Edward VII, is to give the recipe for myself, for Henri Charpentier. It's a marvelous recipe, not easily duplicated, composed of a mother lost and found early in childhood, lucky breaks, a hasty marriage and emigration, and financial ups and downs. The two other books in the Modern Library series consider food as a science, literally. I found Cooking with Pommier, which was first published in France in the 1930s, a little dried out, since it mostly consists of recipes with commentary by famed chef Edouard Dupommier. Historically speaking, though, the book rates recognition because Pamien revolutionized French cuisine by simplifying it and by applying the logic of chemistry to the art of cooking. Perfection Salad by Laura Shapiro is a book I first reviewed, gulp, nearly two decades ago, and I've remembered it fondly ever since. Shapiro unearths the fascinating history of the domestic science movement in America at the turn of the century, the movement that strove to professionalize housewifery and make cooking sanitary and scientific. It's also the movement that gave us such American culinary innovations as home ec classes in high school, white bread, processed cheese, and packaged soup. As Shapiro notes, the women behind the domestic science movement recognized that food was powerful. It could draw forth cravings and greedy desires, which had to be met by a firm hand. Their goal as a group was to transubstantiate food, containing and controlling food, draining it of taste and texture, packaging it. These were some of the major culinary themes of the domestic science movement. Food is powerful. That's the basic belief of all four food books reprinted in the Modern Library series. That belief is also affirmed in the captivating introductions to these books written by famous chefs and food writers like Alice Waters, Elizabeth David, and Michael Stern. The overall editor of this new series is Ruth Reichel, former New York Times restaurant critic, current editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine, and author of the best-selling food memoir, Tender at the Bone. Reichel has a new memoir coming out in April called Comfort Me with Apples, and like its predecessor, it contains exquisite meal-related moments, such as the time when M.F.K. Fisher, the presiding genius of all food writing, arranged an enchanted forest picnic tryst for Reichel and her lover. But be forewarned, because the second memoir deals with the breakup of Reichel's first marriage, the death of her beloved father, and the loss of a child, there's a bitter strain here that wasn't present in the first book. I'm ending this binge by nodding at another superb food memoir, Nora Seaton's The Kitchen Congregation, which has recently come out in paperback. Seaton is a delicate writer who searches through taste and smell for memories of her mother who died young. She made life practical and pretty at once, Seaton writes, remembering how her mother would tie on her apron with a jaunty bow as she was preparing to whisk flour into gravy or lug a roast to the oven. Seaton, like Reichel, also lost a child, and her memoir is a testament to the potency of food to restore, slowly, even the most numbed body back to life. As Seaton acknowledges, time, along with the lentil soups, the lavender honey, and the fresh bread that a family friend cooked up for her, cauterized the wounds they could not heal. Food is powerful, and so is most of the writing in this marvelous mishmash of food books.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, a review of a tribute album to the work of Teresa Stern. This is Fresh Air. Outside the recording industry, Teresa Stern is not a household name, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz doubts that anyone listening doesn't own some recordings that Stern was responsible for. Just before she died last December of Lou Gehrig's disease, Nonesuch, the company she ran for many years, put together a tribute album to her called Teresa Stern, A Portrait. Here's Lloyd's review.
Teresa Stern's friends and colleagues knew her as Tracy and admired her imagination and professionalism as a record producer. But it turns out that most people who knew her didn't know she was also a musical prodigy. She was born in Brooklyn in 1927 and grew up in a musical family. Her mother was a professional cellist who gave up performing in order to further Tracy's career. Both her father and her uncle were violinists. Barely into her teens, she performed with the New York Philharmonic and the NBC Symphony. Amazingly, the acetates from some of her early performances still exist, and they make up one disc of the new two-disc set. She had a lovely, glistening touch of great delicacy and freshness, which you can now hear in some wonderful performances of Bach, Mozart, Liszt, Rachmaninoff, and her mentor, the Dutch composer-conductor David Bruckmann. Listen to her playing the scintillating bit of Bach's Italian Concerto, recorded when she was 11. Stern evidently felt guilty about having a solo career. She called it being a parasite. She took up stenography and typing and eventually became a secretary to the legendary Seymour Solomon, founder of Vanguard and Bach Guild Records. In the early 60s, she was hired by Jack Holtzman to run his fledgling record company Nonesuch, then only a year old. She seemed interested in every kind of music, from Stephen Foster to Elliot Carter, and was a genius at matching artists and repertoire. And she had wonderful taste in performers. She cultivated the late mezzo-soprano Jan de Gaetani and her partner, pianist Gilbert Kalish, beginning with their memorable album of Stephen Foster songs. The brilliant Debussy and Schoenberg piano recordings by Paul Jacobs were under her aegis. She produced William Balcom and Joan Morris's landmark recording of turn-of-the-century parlor ballads, which launched their extraordinary series of classic American song albums. And she practically single-handedly invented the Scott Joplin revival by getting Baroque specialist Joshua Rifkin to do an album of piano rags. Stern also started the ear-opening, mind-expanding Explorer series of world music, long before it was called world music. If you have any of the old Nonesuch recordings of Javanese gamelan music, or music recorded in Turkey, Bulgaria, Zimbabwe, or the Bahamas by native performers, chances are they were produced by Tracy Stern. This rhythmically infectious, affecting selection was recorded at the University of Rhodesia in 1972. Oh, When the recording business started to fall into the hands of international conglomerates, the inconceivable happened. Tracy Stern became a dinosaur. The bottom line wasn't what interested her most. And she was fired from Nonesuch, to the outrage of everyone who cared about recordings as art. Many of the performers she supported left Nonesuch in protest. The climate, though, has changed again. Robert Hurwitz, who took over Nonesuch 5 years after Stern left, is responsible for this tribute album. Stern's own input was indispensable, and at least she got to hear the discs before she died.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Teresa Stern, A Portrait, on the Nonesuch label. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Random House Incorporated Style Press Division, publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel and stories by debut author Justin Cronin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the truth is out there. We meet Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files. This show about FBI agents struggling with the supernatural and government conspiracies has aired on the Fox network since 1993. A new X-Files spinoff, The Lone Gunman, premieres this weekend. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.